Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, coming to you live from my office in lovely Northfield, Illinois, where we have a beautiful day going outside. The sun is shining. Looking forward to getting out there this evening for a nice walk around the block and taking advantage of this good weather that we just don't get enough of. Boy, is there so much going on today. And in fact, we were supposed to have a guest today. We talked about Andres Kirshner joining us on the show. We are still going to have Andres, but due to some scheduling difficulties, we are going to postpone him for a couple of weeks, but we will get him on soon. We thank Andres for his understanding and patience as we get him on the show, and look forward to everything that he can share with us at that time. He's got a great background, and we're very excited to have an opportunity to speak with him very, very soon. Today, though, I've got all sorts of stuff to talk about, so with all due respect to Andres, I'm just going to ramble on and talk what I always like to talk about, the Grateful Dead. June 17th, 36 years ago today, assuming you're listening on Monday, June 17th, 2024. This is an audience tape from the Met Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's the first show of the 1988 Midwest Summer Tour, and I was lucky enough to be there with my good buddies, Mikey and JT. Mikey, of course, is my good buddy who took me to my first Dead show, my second Dead show, my third Dead show, and then a whole bunch of Dead shows after that, including this one. JT is my good buddy from Chicago, who I've known forever, and he was also always a big one for liking to get up and move around and see the Dead, both at home and on the road. And he and I had many a fun getaway to see the Grateful Dead in all sorts of places. And on this particular Friday night, we found ourselves in lovely Minneapolis. It was a Friday night show, but the whole gig was we were actually there for the whole weekend, because back in the day, if you stayed over a Saturday night, your round-trip airfare was significantly less expensive. So we decided, it would, given the price differential, it was worth it to just stay until Sunday and then fly home, which was fine. We got home on a Sunday, headed straight to Alpine Valley for the first of four shows. Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, each night headed home, slept 4 hours, got up for work, left work at 3 p.m., rode the L to the middle of the Kennedy Expressway at Addison, hop in a car and drive straight up the highway to Alpine Valley in East Troy, Wisconsin, fight the crazy post-show traffic in that horrible parking lot, unless you have one-armed Larry as your driver, because he knows how to get out of there better than anybody. This was hardcore. My law firm didn't know what to make of it. I got in four shows at home with no vacation days taken. Shows in another state, I should say. I'm living in Chicago, Illinois. These shows are up in Wisconsin. I could do that kind of stuff back in the day. But let's see how this show started out, because it was a really good one. The show opener, the tour opener. Here we go. Yes, Hell in a Bucket, one of the new songs that quickly became an old song as soon as some new songs came out in the late 80s, and we're all sitting there wondering, you guys don't play St. Stephen enough, why the hell are you coming out with even new tunes? But Hell in a Bucket was one of those that grew on you, and you know, you just got used to seeing it at shows because you would see it a lot. They'd open with it, they'd throw it in the middle of a first set, sometimes you'd see it in a second set. One year at Red Rocks, we saw them go from Scarlet Begonias into Hell in a Bucket. So, you know, they were always having a little bit of fun with it and moving it around. And, you know, it was a Bobby tune. They made a great music video out of it, because when these albums came out in the late 80s, MTV was kicking butt, and everybody made music videos, even the Grateful Dead. I recall it as being kind of a video, but, you know, they gave it their best shot. It just wasn't their style necessarily. Here's what David Dowd had to say about the song. The Bob Weir, John Barlow, Brent Midland song, Hell in a Bucket, directly references the biker scene, and I'm sure that somehow Barlow just wanted to put that element into the band's repertoire somehow. After all, there are plenty of outlaw elements sprinkled throughout the band's songs. Bucket debuted on May 13, 1983 at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California. Alice Kahn wrote a review of the show in which she promulgated one of the best ever Mondegreens, referring to the song as Police on a Joyride. Now, let me just go back and say a couple of things there. For those of you who don't know, a Mondegreen is when you substitute in words for a lyric that you just don't quite understand, but, you know, based on what you're hearing, it makes sense to you. So, at least I'm enjoying the ride. Police on a joyride. I don't know. Maybe. I always figured, I've heard this story for years, I always figured, you know, she must have asked some stone deadhead who just thought it would be funny to give her a funny name and see if she ran with it, and she did. But, you know, there's all sorts of Mondegreens out there for bands like the Grateful Dead and Fish and all of that, because there's just some of these lyrics that you could hear the song a million times and you never quite get it, and then all of a sudden you read it somewhere and you're like, oh yeah, well sure, that makes a lot of sense now. I didn't know why I didn't get it back then. And Mondegreen also happens to be the name of the big Fish Festival going down in Delaware later this summer in mid-August. That I'm going to be lucky enough to attend with my son and his buddies, who are taking me along to introduce me to the heavy side of Fish. When you go to these festivals and, you know, you immerse yourself into the culture and nothing but the culture for four straight days. So, you know, we'll see if I can hold up and how it all goes down, but looking forward to it, and we'll find out if Fish doesn't throw a few Mondegreens our way just to prop up the weekend and play off of the theme of the show. But yes, Police on a Joyride. In fact, a few years later, there was an article in the Chicago Tribune, and I can't tell you that it was Alice Kahn because I don't ever remember her writing for the Chicago Tribune. It was definitely before Greg Kotz era, because Greg's a longtime writer on the Tribune, and I don't think he'd make that kind of a mistake. But, you know, we always used to feel like the local newspapers, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, it was almost like they got somebody who was guaranteed to know absolutely nothing about the Grateful Dead to go out and write the reviews of the shows. And they would always get the names of the songs wrong, and, you know, they would like pick up on things like, oh, look, there were people wearing tie-dye t-shirts, and we'd all be, you're not saying anything about the concert. And, you know, we all wanted to go in there and say, let me do it, but I thought, why bother? I'm having too good of a time at the show. I don't need to go running around. And the problem with being a journalist, I knew because I had tried it in college for a while, is that when you go backstage, you know, oh, look, I get to go interview Garcia or Weir or whatever. If they're having a bad night, if they're not feeling well, if whatever, and, you know, you're just some pesky kid reporter, whoever, you know, you might see a side of them that you never wanted to see. And that certainly happened with me with some athletes and coaches and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm glad I had the experiences that I did in my journalism days. But I'm also kind of glad that I'm, you know, seeing these events now from the perspective of the audience and really getting to enjoy it. That way I can voice my own opinions and not worry about showing bias or anything like that. And, you know, I can listen to what other people try to say and then disagree with them instead of a whole bunch of people disagreeing with me. So, back to Hell in a Bucket. We said that it debuted on May 13th, 83 at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California. The song was frequently featured as a show opener of the course of the next 2+ decades. Although it wasn't used in that role about a year after its first performance, it was performed by the Dead for the final time on June 30th, 1995 at Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hell in a Bucket did appear on In the Dark, released in July 1987, a.k.a. the Touch of Grey album. And yes, if you know, that was your first exposure to the Grateful Dead, then you got there by way of Touch of Grey. I got there by way of Trucking and Friend of the Devil, maybe Uncle John's Band, which were the Dead tunes that received any kind of airplay where I was growing up, when I was growing up in St. Louis in the mid to late 70s and early 1980s. So, you know, you just weren't getting a lot of Grateful Dead radio exposure like you were every other band. And it always amazes me when they have these 70s or 80s flashbacks and they just drop on one of these tunes, like Meatloaf, for instance, that I haven't heard in years. All of a sudden, I can pick right up on the lyrics and sing along with it word for word. And it kind of scares me because I don't ever remember sitting down and making any kind of a conscious effort to learn the words to these songs. You know, and yet here they are. And now when I say, oh, I want to sit down and, you know, learn the words to Dylan's Ballad of a Thin Man that go on for like 4 pages. I'm like, no, there's no way I have the ability to do that kind of thing. But nevertheless, Hell in a Bucket, a great tune from a very fun period of the Grateful Dead. So fun that we all got overran. You know, and I know I used the word we sparingly there because I had only gotten on the bus in 1982. So for me, it was only about a 4 or 5 year swing, maybe just a 6 year swing before Touch of Grey came out. And all of a sudden, everywhere they were playing was Giant Stadium, Soldier Field, you know, the biggest places they could find. And if not, then, you know, always the big outdoor sheds. And the idea of ever seeing them again in a place like Red Rocks was, you know, long gone. Luckily, you know, as I say, I got a little bit of time in before that all happened. You know, on the other hand, the good part about it was is that, you know, you could go anywhere and everywhere and people were deadheads all the time and you no longer felt like, you know, you were kind of like standing out and therefore becoming the lightning rod for everything related. Oh, this guy must smoke marijuana if he likes the Grateful Dead. Must do LSD. Must this, must that. You know, and you're like, come on, guys. Yeah, I do all that, but I like the Grateful Dead just because I like the Grateful Dead, right? Not the other way around. But yep, that was good stuff. And speaking of good stuff, we're going to dip into the next song I want to feature from this show. It's a Brent Midland tune, and it's always got a special place in my heart. From me, from the Go to Heaven album that was released on April 28th, 1980. A very strong Brent tune that I always really liked a lot. The first time I saw it was my second show ever. They opened the second set with it. It was also another show I was at with my good buddy Mikey in the Carrier Dome in Syracuse on September 24th, 1982, the night that I got on the bus forever. And this is what they opened the second set with. Now, in all fairness, they closed the first set with China Rider, so it wasn't like we didn't get the good, you know, double tune jam type of thing. We just got a little bit early at that point. My first Dead show, they closed the first set with Truckin'. They closed this first set with China Rider. You know, I still hadn't even heard a deal or anything like that yet, which of course would come down the road. But Far From Me was just a great song. You know, I was still learning everything about the Grateful Dead at that time, and you know, couldn't say that, you know, anything one way or another was my favorite tune yet. You know, and I had no sense of the order of songs, so it didn't, you know, occur to me that it might be out of order opening the second set. But I fell in love with it because I fell in love with that entire show, right from top to bottom with a Jack Straw opener, China Rider closer, second set open with Far From Me, with a playing Crazy Fingers, Throwing Stones into the Drums in Space. I know this isn't the show we're featuring today, but I'm just reminiscing for a minute, so sorry. Came out of the space into Iko Iko, which was probably at that point my peak high moment in life. Catching that Iko, which I had never heard before and only had just become vaguely familiar with. Another Truckin', so all of a sudden I'm 2 for 2 on Truckin'. They throw in a Going Down the Road, Black Peter, Around and Around, Sugar Magnolia. That's 5 songs going into the drum, 6 songs coming out of it. Broke Down Palace, what a great night. But the Far From Me just really resonated with me, and I always loved it. You know, I think that Brent, I think he felt sometimes like he was, you know, could never get over the idea of being the new guy and that, you know, it was hard to get credit or something. But, you know, I know there was a whole group of us out there that really loved that music. We love that song. We like a lot of his other songs, too. You know, and it's just great whenever you get to hear it. This happened to be a night in Minnesota when we got to hear it again with my good buddy Mikey. This time it wound up in the middle of the first set, actually, right? The show, we heard it open with A Hell in a Bucket. There was a great Sugar Ree, a really great Minglewood, and Roe Jimmy into this. They went on to do Masterpiece, Althea, and we'll get some of the other tunes here in a second. But, you know, just a lot of fun up there in Minnesota at the Met Center. You know, not necessarily the greatest venue in the world to see a show, but certainly not the worst by any means. And for Mikey, JT, and I, we were just having a great night all around, so it didn't really matter all that much. And enjoyed the idea of, you know, not just traveling, but that I knew I was going to be coming back and, you know, rushing up to Alpine to catch four more. So it was going to basically be, you know, five shows over 7 days, which, you know, may have been my peak concentration throughout the entire time I was a Deadhead. But you know, you just know you're coming off of something great, and you're about to head into something great, and it all revolves around the Dead and your good friends and all of that kind of stuff. And it was always a wonderful, wonderful thing. Now we're going to branch off for a couple of minutes here, and we're going to jump into music news, because we've got some good and interesting stories going on here. And as we make that jump, Dan, what do you got for us?
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing,
we will rock you.
Yeah, We Will Rock You from Queen, that wonderful British rock band, on their 1987 album, News of the World. It was written by guitarist Brian May. Rolling Stone ranked it number 330 on their 500 Greatest Songs of All Time in 2024, and it was placed on number 146 on the Songs of the Century in 2001. In 2009, it was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. Other than the last 30 seconds, which contains May's excellent guitar solo, the song is generally set in an a cappella form, using only stomping and clapping as a rhythmic body percussion beat. In 77, We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions were issued together as a worldwide top 10 single, and many radio stations just played the two songs consecutively without interruption, leading to some confusion as to whether they were one song or two songs. You'd hear We Will Rock You all the time when the stadiums were trying to get, you know, the fans rocked and rolling and, you know, to support their team. And you'd hear We Are the Champions whenever your team won the World Series or the Super Bowl or, you know, whatever it was. And, you know, in some respects, it never really does get old. But in other respects, you know, you can only hear it so many times before it gets to you. But that's always some great lead-in music. Thank you to Dan. And by the way, just for those out there who are keeping score at home and may want to know this, today, which is actually June 12th, happens to be Dan's birthday. So we never like to pass by without shouting happy birthday to our good friend and producer, Mr. Humiston, without whom this podcast would never exist. And he's probably 45 or something and, you know, just likes to be shy and not ever tell anybody anything else. So we're going to run with that until Carson corrects us otherwise. But happy birthday to Dan, and thank you for everything that you do for this show and for helping us get out such great stuff every week. Good. Now that we've sufficiently embarrassed him, we can move on, and we're going to revisit this story right now, because last week, you know, I didn't quite know what to make of it. As you may recall, last week we told the story of the fish head who was at the fish show and decided to rip the first bong ever in the sphere, which wasn't enough for him. He took a picture, he took videos of it, he posted it on his social media site or whatever you do with these things when you send them around to the world, and he specifically targeted the band and Madison Square Garden Entertainment, the group, again, that owns the sphere. And as we told you, about a week later, he gets a letter from MSG Entertainment saying, dear sir, thanks for bringing this to our attention. You violated every one of our rules, for legal rules and good sportsmanship and whatever else they wanted to slap him around with, and basically told him that that's it. You are, you know, indefinitely suspended from all of our music venues. This isn't just the Sphere or Madison Square Garden, but included the Beacon Theater. It may have included the Capitol Theater. I don't remember. I know it included the Chicago Theater in Chicago, which surprised me. I didn't realize that was part of the chain. But these are, you know, these are a lot of theaters to be barred from. And, you know, the guy didn't really seem all that bummed out. We talked about, hey, you know, look, at a minimum, at least he's the cool dude that can always say he ripped the first bong ever in the Sphere, although we weren't 100% certain that that was accurate, but I'm going to accept it on faith. After all this guy's gone through, he deserves it. Last week, Madison Square Garden Entertainment has redacted the veto, citing it as an error resulting from a breakdown in our process. Now, this is fascinating to me as an attorney. I said that I thought that them, you know, vetoing him out forever was a little bit on the harsh side. They could have called him out. They could have given him a one-month suspension, you know, but they went straight to DEFCON 5, and they just said, that's it. You're out forever. Okay. And, you know, I'm like, well, I mean, what are you going to do? Less than a week, they come back and they tell us, oh, it was an error resulting from a breakdown in our process. Now, you just have to say, it's a little funny and it's a little embarrassing. Madison Square Garden Entertainment is not your local mom-and-pop shop when it comes to producing plays in the backyard with your grandson playing ukulele. This is the real deal. You know, these are the boys from the East Coast. They know how to do this stuff. So, on Saturday, June 8th, the fallacy was acknowledged when the official spokesperson of Sphere Entertainment commented, quote, there was a breakdown in our process due to a change in personnel which resulted in the letter sent inadvertently. This customer is not banned from our properties. However, it is still against our policies, which are in accordance with local laws, to smoke, bring glassware into our venues, and disrupt other fans' enjoyments of the events, close quote. Wow. Let's break this down for a minute. There was a breakdown in our process doing a change in personnel, which resulted in the letter being sent. So what they're telling us is they didn't mean to send the letter, right? Which means ripping a bong hit in the Sphere, apparently, is not sufficient grounds to get you kicked out. Now, I'm not telling you I'm going to try and sneak a bong in there, but what's the message you're really sending here, guys? I mean, you know, and then when he goes on to say, well, it's still against our policy. No, it's not. You're giving this guy a complete pass. You just told us that the letter to ban him permanently was inadvertently sent out due to a change in personnel, somebody who didn't know better, right? Which must mean your policy is, now, if you rip a bong hit in there, we're okay. So that's the good news, you know, and even better news for this guy. Now he's a hero's hero. Not only did he get the first bong rip in the Sphere, but he got the ban, and then he won, apparently without even having to file an appeal. This is great stuff. I'd hire him as my attorney, you know, the next time I get a bad ruling, because this guy, this is just amazing. You know, I don't know how that happened or how they got this pulled out, but, you know, folks, this is just, this is a really, really good thing. I am I'm very impressed, and I am impressed with MSG Entertainment for, you know, being on top of this and, you know, recognizing a mistake and coming out and acknowledging it. But, you know, how you just can't walk away from this with any feeling other than bong rips in the Sphere are not really a prohibited thing. And we'll have to see. And I would assume that would apply to all their properties, right, that we were talking about before. Madison Square Garden, Radio City Music Hall. I didn't mention the Beacon Theater, Chicago Theater, Sphere, other MSG venues. Maybe not the Capitol Theater. Is that Howard Shapiro? I don't know who has all of these. I can't keep track of them all. But at any rate, that's a good story. That's a feel-good story. You know, we never like it when one of our own who's going out to see these shows gets themselves in trouble, even if they are acting a little bit silly or, you know, a little too out in the open and kind of asking for it, as it were. But this just has a great story and a great ending all the way around. Speaking of the Sphere, you make of this whatever you want to make of this. I don't know what to make of this because it just doesn't seem right to me. But Dead & Company Sphere tickets are listed for face value or below on cash or trade. Dead & Company has announced 24 dates at the Las Vegas Sphere. Many fans eagerly bought tickets. Now some can't attend and are selling their tickets at face value or less on cashortrade.org, built by fellow Deadheads in 2009 to protect fans from scalp tickets. Now, I don't have any experience with cashortrade.org, but I've been hearing about it a lot more, and so it's kind of funny to see it here as well. You know, this is unfortunate all the way around, right? Because on the one hand, you know, look, I'm always happy when Deadheads can get, you know, good pricing, but I'm not happy if the pricing is coming from other Deadheads, you know, because I always like to hope that, you know, one Deadhead selling to another, you know, you'd pretty much sell for face value. You know, you wouldn't have to give away a miracle ticket, but, you know, for face value or maybe very, very minimal markup or something, if they're going to be sitting next to you, you know, beers are on you tonight kind of thing, you know. But so I really like the idea of cash or trade. But on the other hand, you know, deadheads who went out and bought their tickets and now they can't go are kind of getting squeezed out of even being able to make their own money back. But, you know, 24 shows, you know, plus the possibility of some new ones being added on top of that, that's a lot of shows for Dead & Company in one location, more or less, you know, playing, you know, the same group of, I don't know, 75 songs, maybe. Maybe that's too large of a number. Maybe it's of, you know, 60 songs. I have no idea. I mean, somebody could sit down and count them out. I'm not going to take the time to do it. But if you want to and email me, that would be awesome. But the point is, right, that you can say whatever you want about Phish. They played four shows in the Sphere. They were all completely different. We talked about their Baker's Dozen when they did 13 shows across the board, you know, without repeating a song. And, you know, I get it. The Dead never were a band that went, you know, an indefinite amount of shows without repeating a song. What they were was a band who every night played a different set list. And there could be some songs that wound up in the set list, maybe a couple of nights in a row, especially if they were on the newer side or if the band was really liking them. You know, some that might appear at the first night of the tour and then not show up again until the last night of the tour. You know, that kind of a thing. But never a situation, and more or less what Phish is now. You know, Phish, you know, even now will start, you know, I'll find out because I'm going to be seeing a lot of shows this summer. But I would figure, you know, by the third or fourth show, I mean, if it's a three-show run like at Alpine, then you go into St. Louis for two shows. I'm guessing in St. Louis you will hear songs that you heard up in Alpine. It may not be a lot. It may, you know, or maybe it would be. I don't know. We'll find out. But that's just the way the bands play. They've practiced certain tunes. You know, they're really into certain tunes at the moment. And they like to play certain tunes. And, you know, we'll see where it goes with that. But that's tough. I mean, not to mention the fact that it's freaking 110 degrees in Las Vegas. You know, and you're asking people to, now once you're inside the Sphere, it's lovely, but, you know, people have to find something to do with themselves during the day, and, you know, even sitting outside by the pool is just really brutal. You get up to try and run and get in the pool. Lynn knows this, good buddy Mikey's wonderful girlfriend Lynn, who was out there with us for the Dead & Co. show that I was at a couple of weeks ago, and we spent the next day hanging out by the pool at the Virgin Hotel, me and her and good buddy Mikey, and we got our seats finally to sit down by the pool, and they were in the sand, and she's like, if you're going to get up, make sure you put your shoes on, and of course, I didn't listen. I just got up and started to walk across the sand to go to the bathroom, and my feet are on fire. So, you know, always listen to Lynn. She knows what she's talking about when it comes to that kind of stuff. But seriously, it turns everything out there. You know, they have stainless steel, you know, bars to grab onto as you're walking upstairs. You touch one of them, you're like burning your hand off. You know, who designed that? I don't know. That's crazy. But the point is that, you know, people aren't going to keep going back to Las Vegas week after week after week. And my sense is that Las Vegas, although it has an ever-growing population now of permanent residents, I can't tell you how many of them, you know, are deadheads or would go to see this show at all, let alone go to see it on multiple nights. You know, so it seems to me the people who ran out and bought tickets, and I'm going to guess there probably are people who bought multiple nights or maybe over multiple weekends. And, you know, it may be that people say, you know, look, I love it. That's too much. I'll come back one more weekend, but not two or three more weekends. I don't know. But the point is, if you want to go see them, you can go see them. And it's not very expensive. So, you know, I would certainly, you know, recommend that you check that out. Now, the next story that we're going to talk about is a little weird one because it's following up on what we were just talking about, but in an interesting kind of way. Roger Daltrey, who, let's give Roger his props, the man who's saying, I hope I die before I get old, is now either pushing 80 or has turned 80. He's still touring, and he's still belting out tunes, both with Pete Townshend as The Who, and he's getting ready to launch a big solo tour that he's going to go around the world on. And that's great. People love Roger Daltrey. He has a great voice. He's a showman. I will tell you that Mick Jagger's an amazing showman, you know, and a front man, and Steven Tyler with Aerosmith is, and, you know, there's a bunch of these guys out there who really fill that role. Steve Perry with Journey. Nobody like Roger Daltrey. I know Mick is be right up there with him. You know, he runs around and jumps around and does all sorts of crazy shit at 80 years old. But the young Roger Daltrey, or relatively young Roger Daltrey, the first time that I saw him way back in 1980 with good buddy Mark and Harold from Chicago down in St. Louis, he'd come down to visit for the weekend and talked his parents into letting him stay a couple of extra days so we could all go see The Who with the tickets that we had managed to talk my mom into taking me to the post office to mail order for. because a few months earlier they had that big stampede in Cincinnati where people died, and they weren't necessarily inclined to let us go until we pointed out how, oh no, these are reserved seats and that won't happen. And we went in, and it changed my life as a rock and roll fan. It was, like I say, the first time I saw a big boy rock and roll show, and they did not disappoint. But to see Roger Daltrey in the front of that stage swinging that microphone around, and I'm not like talking around in a big, you know, Ferris wheel circle, although he did that too, but over his head, swinging, 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 and then knowing exactly when to yank on it so that it would come flying out of its circle smack into his hand just as he belted into the next verse, right? And I went home and tried something like that once and probably knocked, you know, three vases off the shelf, and that was the last time I ever tried. But here's why we're talking about Roger today, and I think he maybe is just getting a little crotchety in his old age, right? So, touching on his feelings toward revealing the contents of a performance and online, Daltrey asserted, "I'm not going to talk about songs." Providing reasoning, he added, "Too many people reveal songs. There's no surprise left with concert these days because everyone wants to see the set list. I'm fucking sick of it. The internet's ruined the live shows for me. Who wants to know what's coming next? People forget about surprises. I can't stand it." Okay, so I understand what Roger's saying here. And you go on a lot of shows, and, you know, a lot of times performers have the set list, taped on the stage right underneath where they're standing. The piano player has it taped on the side. Sometimes you can get one of them to give it to you, or if you know a guy who works backstage, they'll get it for you. And it's not uncommon to go online and social media and see somebody who took a picture of the set list and posted it. And there's no doubt that, you know, if you go see Roger Daltrey the next night and he's playing the same songs, you might lose some of the surprise if, in fact, he's, playing something special and he was going to play it special again and he wanted people to know. But guess what? And here's an idea for you, Roger. Don't play the exact same show every night. You know, mix up your songs, and then set lists can only give you probabilities of what might get played. It can't guarantee you for every night. See the Grateful Dead and Fish and every other jam band ever. And we follow those set lists religiously, not to see what they're playing that night, but yeah, to see what they're playing on the tour. And is Roger right? I mean, even if they're playing different songs every night, let's say we all went to Hampton in 1986 and towards the beginning of the spring tour, and we saw Box of Rain Breakout. I suppose you could make an argument that if they're going to go around the country or on their tour and Phil's going to start playing Box of Rain now, that how fun would that be if you heard it, you know, and you had no idea that it was coming. But that's not the way rock and roll works, ever. Long before, because it was while the Grateful Dead were out there playing those kind of shows, but long before I was following the Grateful Dead, you were following other bands. You know, you would, even if there wasn't a set list, you know, if some band came out and broke out a tune for the first time in a long time, you know, all you had to do was read the local newspaper if they were writing a review about it, because most music critics were, you know, at least, you know, in tune enough to be able to pick up on something like that, and you would say, oh yeah, that's cool. But I mean, really, what does Roger Daltrey think in today's day and age? Let's imagine that there's no set list, and he comes out and he decides to do side B from Tommy all the way through, and he wants people to be, you don't think people aren't going to get on the internet and say, oh my God, I went to the show tonight and Roger Daltrey played side B from Tom? Of course they are. And of course every guy who's writing, you know, every journalist who's there covering the concert, that's the news. Once you play it, it's out there. That's what Garcia said. Mix up your set lists. Because I got news for you, Roger. If you're going to play the same show every night, you'd have to be a really diehard Roger fan to go to more than one or two shows on that tour, you know, or at least maybe one or two in the beginning and then one or two in the end or something. But if you know he's going to play the same thing every night, with or without a set list, that's not a recipe for success. So I'm thinking that maybe Roger didn't quite think this all the way through. Maybe he was having a rough day or something. I don't know. I like to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's a great guy, Roger Daltrey, like I say. And I've always loved his music. I've always loved his singing. And I'm just giving him a hard time for the sake of giving him a hard time because he's not standing right next to me where he can pop me in the nose. So that's Roger. Moving on. This past weekend... A week ago yesterday, my wife and I went out to the Salt Shed in Chicago for one of their outdoor shows, and I could not have been more impressed with the whole setup for the outdoor shows. could not have been more impressed with the way they were finally the security, that running the security. They must have heard me bitch at them when I went to Phil Lesh earlier in the year, and the little guy who really wants to be a police officer gave me a hard time and grabbed my marijuana away from me and, you know, was not very nice about it. But I'm back there. The shows are too good to miss, and they've got it all worked out, and everybody went in, and those who wanted to smoke, smoked, and those who didn't, and we all had a great time. Now, for those of you who haven't seen Krung Bin and you don't know who they are, what they're like, you know, my response would be that I think they're an acquired taste. I like the sound. They have a very, very minimalist stage design. It like goes up in steps, and then there's a, you know, where it finally platforms across, and they stick the drummer up there, and they have a backdrop that has three arches, and they're all one for each of them, and the guitar player and the bass player, and yes, I have not learned their names yet, so you'll have to forgive me for that, but I just haven't. You know, every song, like they move their microphone stand over here and they go over there, you know, and they like move across the stage. One's going one way, one's a step up going the other way, you know, and almost kind of like a slow motion what kind of walk that Chuck Berry used to do, like when he'd get down really low and kind of hop across the stage, the chicken dancer walk, or, you know, I mean, they would just do things that were very, very, very thought out, you know, and like I say, planned. It was very artistic. I would have probably preferred a little bit less of that and just some more jamming, because they certainly sound like excellent musicians. But, you know, the way that I describe their music overall when I talked to some of my friends later was, all night long it kept sounding like they were the Grateful Dead coming out of space, but you never got the big launch into whatever it very invariably follows. It just kind of stayed at that same level all the way through. And, you know, for somebody who's never seen them before, quite frankly, it was very hard to tell when one song began, when a new one began. I just did not have, you know, enough knowledge of their catalog, and people who do, I'm sure, of course, don't suffer from that problem. But, you know, nevertheless, I would say that it was a very, very fun night. The encore that they played, and again, I don't know the name of the song, but it was my favorite tune of the night. I mean, they came out just really jamming hard on that. I'm like, where was this jamming all night? I would certainly see them again, but this time around, preferably with some psychedelics involved. I could then maybe better appreciate how the big screens up on the stage, they kept them blurry all night, just enough so, you know, you can't really see them, or you can't quite see what they're doing on stage clearly. You can just see the images moving around. And it's a great effect if you're tripping, but it's hard on your eyes if you're not. And of course, I'm a little bit older, so maybe it's just hard on my eyes. It was a good crowd, you know, fairly mellow. Lots of tats on people there, which, you know, my wife and I noticed right away, and felt both, you know, much younger than most people there, and very much a blank canvas in terms of not having any tats myself. As I said, my first outdoor show at Space, right on the North Branch of the Chicago River, with the city skyline completely visible. A very comfortable, enjoyable Sunday night with my wife. Fun had by all. I would give it a solid B, and I'm going to have to go out and start buying some of their albums, because based on the way they play them live, my sense is that, you know, you can listen to it on the album and you're getting a similar sound. It you know, maybe they jam it out a little bit longer. We'll find out. But certainly we're going to check that out. And so, yes, Krung Bin, if they come by you and you have a chance, go see them. And, yeah, you know, let me know what you think. Finally, I did promise last week that I had literally just been handed the story from my wife and quickly from a few other good friends about Trey coming out and playing with Billy Joel in Madison Square Garden a week ago. So I was able to get a little bit more information on there, and I know that you can go onto relics.com and find the story, and you know, they have a link that'll take you directly to the video. I would highly recommend it because, you know, although they come from two different eras of rock and roll, they both love to rock out. They both love to jam. And notwithstanding their friendly rivalry on who owns the Madison Square Garden more than the other, They're both consummate musicians, and Billy Joel, you know, is an excellent piano player, plays in a number of different styles and genres and tempos and all of that kind of stuff, and he's a prolific songwriter. And Trey Anastasio, you know, plays the guitar like he was born with it in his hands, and I forgot which one of his Fish members said it's like he shits music. It just comes out of him so naturally and so easily, and it's a great opportunity to see such talented musicians. Billy Joel, from, you know, a little bit more of the younger part of my musical career, again, he was late high school and throughout college and, you know, early adulthood. And now Fish, who, although I certainly could have gotten into them sooner, has been, you know, more of a latecomer to them, and you know, and enjoying all of their music. But it's just really fun that they came out and played together. They teamed up on a few songs, including Sleeping with the Television On, You May Be Right, You May Be Crazy, a cover of Derek and the Dominoes, the outro, if you will, the instrumental outro of the song Layla, which is a marvelous tune for them to have played, because Trey knows it really well, having played in the Layla cover with Tedeschi Trucks Band at Lockin' a few years ago. And it wouldn't matter, Trey could play it anyway. And he's just jamming the guitar parts, and Billy Joel is expertly playing keyboards behind it and adding just a lovely element, a lovely sound to it, that's, you know, in addition to the sound that we were used to with Derek and the Dominoes, and, you know, just a true rocker. And then they touched very briefly on Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll, which Mike Del Judas got up and sang a little bit of. But, you know, my sense is Trey's out there with a big smile on his face. Billy Joel's out there with a big smile on his face. And why shouldn't they be, you know? I think that they're both kind of honoring one another with the way they do it there. And, you know, good for them. You know, they're both going to play a lot. I get the sense that their fan bases, you know, there may be some overlap, especially, you know, for the older Fish fans who have, the same kind of memories of Billy Joel that I do when I saw him and Elton John at Wrigley Field a few years back. You know, and I know I've mentioned this story before, sorry, but I just like to mention stories. You know, they played, and I probably knew every word to 95% of the songs just from the two of them, having listened to it for so long. And so that's almost like an old home week show for me. You know, I remember seeing Billy Joel my freshman year of college in, you know, one of the big arenas in downtown Detroit, and going down there with a group of friends, and oh my God, was that the best? You know, we were out in the town and we were seeing Billy Joel, and we still knew every word to every song, and it was great. So excellent that it happened. Thank you to my wife Judy, thank you to my cousin Susie, thank you to my son Matthew, and everybody else who thought of me and sent me notices about it. But it just goes to show, fans, you never know. That's why you go to the shows and you stay through the whole show, because you don't know what they're going to play. You don't know who's going to show up on stage, and you don't know if it will ever happen again. And nobody wants to miss out on anything like that. Okay, back to our show from 36 years ago today, June 17th, 1988, at the Met Center in Minneapolis. And here we go, coming out to start the second set.
Second failed before the main.
So I had to play a long clip here, Victim of the Crime, because this is the first time the Dead ever played it. It was, again, one of the, you know, quote-unquote new songs of the late 1980s. It was written by Bob Weir, and interestingly, the lyrics were by Garrett Graham and not by John Perry Barlow, who did so much of the lyrics work for Bobby's tunes. Here's a great quote by Jerry Garcia on it, on Victim of the Crime. He says, "It's one of Weir's stunningly odd compositions, but it's also very adventurous. It's uncompromising. It is what it is, and the challenge of coming up with stuff to play that sounds intelligent in the context has been incredible, but also appropriately gnarly. I really wanted that part of it to work. I think we did a nice job on the record with it. It works. Whatever it is, it works. I'm real happy with it because it was one of those things that was like, what are we going to do with this? It's like having a monster brother that you lock in the attic. It's like a relative that you're like, God, I hope nobody comes over when he's eating. But that's one of the things that makes the Grateful Dead fun. The text of it, I don't believe I've ever actually listened to all of the words of it, ever. I have the gist of it by now. I could probably recite it if I really had to, but the text of it is more of the same in a way. It doesn't have the whole lot of light in it. It's very dense and it's angst-ridden to boot." I love Jerry Garcia. Can you imagine that? I don't know exactly when he gave this quote, but how many times did he stand up on stage next to Bob listening? I'll tell you how many times. 96! And he says that, "I don't believe I've ever actually listened to all of the words of it, ever." That's funny. It was played 96 times. It, you know, it debuted right here at this show. We were lucky enough to catch it, me and good buddy Mikey and JT. I made a mistake. It closed the first set. It did not open the second set. My apologies. China Ryder opened the second set. It remained in the rotation thereafter and was played for the final time on July 2nd, 1995 at the Deer Creek Music Center in Noblesville, Indiana. Victim of the Crime, like some of, but not all of it, but certainly some of Bobby's new tunes that came out during that period, got a lot of pushback and, very split among the Deadheads. If you read the comments, you know, online and other places where concert and this song appears, some people call it the worst Bob Weir song of all time, the worst Grateful Dead song of all time. Other people say, you know, it's Bobby, you know, doing a great job and coming up with a fun tune that really moves along, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, my feeling on it is with all of these tunes is you may not like them at first, and, you know, you may not like them as they go along, but eventually one day you're at one of the shows and you realize, you know, this tune's not bad. I've heard it enough times now that it's kind of grown on me, and that's happened with me with Dead tunes, with Fish tunes, other bands, you know, and sometimes it's just a matter of hearing it enough times to really develop a taste for it. And I certainly appreciate the energy that he brings to that tune. And the way he, you know, it was a perfect encapsulation of where they were at the 80s. Bobby, you know, in the short shorts, cut off shorts right up in the front of the stage, screaming and yelling, gesturing at the crowd with his hands, really trying to get him going. Garcia back at his microphone, you know, we're all hoping he doesn't fall asleep or anything. And just amazing the crowds night after night after night. And this next one that we're going to play for you right now, which followed pretty much right after a few songs after Victim of the Crime, is another great song that was being played during that era that often got the crowd moving as well. Thank you. Along the Watchtower, sung by American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan from his 8th studio album, John Wesley Harding, which came out in 1967. The song was written by Dylan and produced by Bob Johnston. Covered by numerous artists, All Along the Watchtower is strongly identified with the interpretation Jimi Hendrix recorded with the Jimi Hendrix Experience for their third studio album, Electric Ladyland, that was released in 1968. The Hendrix version, released 6 months after Dylan's original recording, became a top 20 single in 1968, received a Grammy Hall of Fame Award in 2001, and was ranked 48th in Rolling Stone magazine's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time in 2004, 40th in the 2021 version. Dylan first played the song live in concert on the Bob Dylan and the Band 1974 tour, which was his first tour since 1966. His live performances have been influenced by Hendrix's cover to the extent that they may have been called covers of cover, right? Now he's covering Hendrix covering him. The singer has performed the song live, this Dylan we're talking about, more than any of his other ones, with over 2,250 recitals of that tune. That's amazing. That's just an amazing number of times to sing one song. And the thing with this, you know, with Jimmy, the Jimi Hendrix version, is that certainly I originally, and so many people I know, always grew up with the impression that All Along the Watchtower was, in fact, a Jimi Hendrix tune. And even if you heard Bob Dylan sing it, I remember, you know, at the time, well, I know Jimi Hendrix, I guess I know Bob Dylan, but yeah, maybe Bob Dylan covered Jimi Hendrix tune. No. We all learned that's, you know, that's not the way it is. We've had stories about Dylan touring this past year in Japan and in some parts of Europe and some parts of the States, and covering a few Grateful Dead tunes, and, you know, how fun that is and enjoyable for him. But no. All Along the Watchtower is, in fact, a Bob Dylan tune. We love the Jimi Hendrix version, and that is essential rock and roll listening. But, you know, credit where credit is due, and this is Bob's tune. I always loved the Grateful Dead's cover of it. As you heard in this clip, it's just a rocking tune. Jerry loved it as much as anybody, and he would really get into it. Bobby, you know, with the howling lyrics and everything like that. A really, really good, snappy second set tune that always got the crowd moving and kind of going into the next gear. So that was really good. We are now going to segue over into the marijuana side of things. We've got the marijuana news to go. And Dan, what do you got for us today?
Smoke the weed, the herb, the sea. I smoke that Buddha because it relaxes me. The mota, the yesca, the ganja, and the burrito. I vaporize the cannabis to boost my libido. The dope, the indica, the hydro pine. I pack the bowl and then I pull that.
Yeah, Cheech and Chong, once you start with them, you can never stop. Also from the animated Cheech and Chong movie, I just call them to the cannabis industry, the gift that keeps on giving. And, you know, there's nobody who hasn't heard of Cheech and Chong. Maybe not everyone enjoyed the movies. Maybe not everyone saw one of their movies. But they're just out there all the time, and it's kind of hard to miss them. Obviously, Cheech Marin has gone on to have a film and television career independent of Tommy Chong, and Tommy Chong's gone off and was selling all sorts of glassware and stuff like that, and just going around being everybody's resident expert on marijuana, and, you know, deservedly so. They carved out those personalities for themselves, and they were also part of the stuff that we were listening to back in the day. You know, long before we tried marijuana, we were laughing our butts off listening to Cheech and Chong talk about it, and, you know, not really, of course, quite understanding what it was all about. But I remember after I started getting high the first couple of times, thinking, oh, wow, now I start to get some of their humor a little bit more, and, you know, what they were saying and what, you know, what that was all about. So hats off to Cheech and Chong. Okay, now here's some interesting marijuana news that I want to share, again, from our good friends over at Marijuana Moment. And what we find out in a recent story is that the Biden administration is reconsidering the longstanding federal hardline stance on cannabis, ushering in pardons for marijuana-based offenses and proposing reclassifying the drug, right? So we know that that he's been doing that. While proponents of social equity in the marijuana industry are cheering on the sentiment, they say These more lenient federal gestures, which are silent on established state cannabis regulations, could create confusion. They also have a new concern, tobacco and alcohol industries bigfooting into the market. The word of caution is that at this point, because it's federally illegal, tobacco, alcohol, and pharmaceutical companies are not involved, said Shailene Tidal, a former member of the state's Cannabis Control Commission and now founder and director of the Parabola Center for Law and Law Policy Think Tank. They have been waiting in the wings, so we have to understand with federal legalization that will change, and there are precautions that we will want to take. The title then jumped from Massachusetts cannabis regulation to federal policy work at the end of 2020, joining a coalition of drug policy experts and lawyers pushing for substantial marijuana reform. She discussed the Bay State's evolution on cannabis policy and its place in an increasingly complex state-federal cannabis environment on an episode of the Horse Race podcast co-hosted by Commonwealth Beacon reporter Jennifer Smith and Mass Inc. Poland Group President Steve Cozella. A federal move to reschedule marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 of the Controlled Substances Act, redefining it from a substance with no medical use and a high potential for abuse to one with a medical use and a moderate to low potential for abuse, prompted mixed responses from the advocates. Dr. Rahul Gupta, director of the Office of Natural Drug Policy, told Florida NPR station WGCU that the move is a recommendation based on science and evidence, adding, "It doesn't make sense to make sure that we're pursuing science and evidence when it comes to medication and use those medications for Americans with chronic illnesses, chronic pain, diseases like cancer." But Tidal said the administration is mischaracterizing the rescheduling proposal by making it seem like a straightforward shift when there are still many unanswered questions about how the change would impact prescription access and production, let alone interact with states that have regulations banning both recreational and medicinal cannabis. The proposal is completely out of line with what the states are doing, she said. It does not legalize anything about state programs. The federal policy tilt, she said, prompted by Parabola to take a step back and look at what people actually want when it comes to legalization. And in particular, it's really important to understand that different policies will benefit different groups of people. Tidal said she came to the conclusion that Massachusetts could do a much better job on worker protections prior to a new Parabola survey, but priorities reinforced her view. Of those surveyed, 73% said cannabis legalization should benefit workers in the cannabis industry. A Bay State cannabis worker suffered an asthma attack at a Holyoke processing facility and died in 2002. The survey of 404 American adults was initially intended to be an internal Parabola tool to test education messaging on cannabis use, Tidal said, but the organization decided to release its publicity to highlight a few new trends. So there's really a lot going on, and you know, this is very interesting as to what's happening here and what people are saying. People aren't happy with this. Now, these are for different reasons, but it's as we talked about, if it becomes a Schedule 3, does that mean that only Big Pharma and licensed pharmacists can now service it? Because that's the case for every other controlled substance, Schedule 1, 2, and 3. So nobody really knows how this is going to break down, right? On the drug side, I'm sure they would argue, hey, the law and order side, the prohibitionist side, they would argue that if we move it all the way off the schedules, then there's going to be a big problem for sure. On the other hand, I think Big Pharma would really like that, because then they would be free to go to town on this without any concerns. And I have heard more than a few license holders in the semi-legal industry that we exist in today saying they like it because it keeps out really big companies and it keeps out, you know, other competition from people who don't, really have the risk factor that you need, to be able to engage in this business and, you know, be aware of the fact that you are breaking federal law and, you know, still manage to go about running your business. So there's just a lot happening with that. And look, the sooner the feds can get this all worked out, the better. And it shouldn't take 15 times to pass a Safe Banking Act that everybody's in agreement should pass. It shouldn't take so long to pass the SAFE Act for the states, so that, you know, we start treating states that have medical marijuana programs as being federally legal states for marijuana, and we, you know, start making a slow transition over to it that way, and all sorts of so many other things, you know, to really open the door for banking once and for all, you know, and you know, to let banks know that, you know, they're no longer on the hook for possible money laundering charges that, you know, could be very, very dangerous based on improper or incorrect reporting by the customers that bank their money with them. You know, and so we just really need to see this move forward and do what it's going to do and get us to where we want it to get us. Here's another interesting story that we're going to touch on. One of the GOP congressmen, in fact, two Republican congressmen, are challenging the basis of the conviction of President Joe Biden's sons, his son Hunter, for purchasing a gun while being a consumer of illegal drugs, with one pointing out that there are millions of marijuana users who own guns but should not be prosecuted. After a federal jury found Hunter Biden guilty of three felony charges related to his purchase of a firearm while being a user of crack cocaine, by the way, only a Schedule II, on Tuesday, Representative Thomas Massey, a Republican from Kentucky, said he might deserve to be put in jail for something. Of course, that's, you know, I would expect that. That's the conservative line. But purchasing a gun is not it. Okay, now we've got the gun rights people matching up with the marijuana people. And this is great, right? Massey's never been a huge promoter of marijuana, even though he's from Kentucky. You know, he's also not for locking people up, you know, especially in gun situations, because that can quickly spread, which is against the interest of gun control, gun rights users, and all of those people, right? There are millions of marijuana users who own guns in this country, and none of them should be in jail for purchasing or possessing a firearm against current laws, the congressman said. This past December, attorneys for Hunter Biden called on a federal court to dismiss the case against their client based on a similar principle, arguing the prosecutors are applying an unconstitutional statute that would criminalize millions of marijuana consumers acting in compliance with state laws if broadly enforced. The federal statute banning people who use cannabis from buying or possessing firearms has been challenged in multiple federal courts over the years, with one case pending a review in the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, you know, this is interesting because this has been going on for a while, and I think that a lot of people out there recognize that this, you know, this shouldn't be the problem that it is. If we're going to allow guns in this country, and if we're going to recognize marijuana as being legal in parts of this country, or at least, you know, not criminal, we can't have a federal law that continues to prohibit the two of them being used together, either by people who sell marijuana or by people who purchase and smoke marijuana. Right? That's just not realistic. And it's a stupid rule. It's not fair to the marijuana industry. It's not fair to gun owners. And I'm no fan of guns. I'm the first one to tell you that I think we need much stricter gun laws in this country. And, you know, guns more than anything are responsible for high levels of violence that we see all across the country, and for deaths in families and suicides and children's deaths and all of that. But we're not here to talk about the pros and cons of guns. We're here to talk about the idea that one should bar the other. Now, it's interesting because he got a little bit of pushback from people saying, hey, idiot, you know, what you're really talking about, you know, Hunter Biden uses crack cocaine. You're making comments about marijuana. And that's true. And people instinctively, look what they do there. They go right to suggest that somehow the crack cocaine is worse. It's not. Crack cocaine is on Schedule 2. Marijuana is on Schedule 1. That's always been the problem with marijuana on Schedule 1. The hypocrisy, the stupidity, the ridiculousness of all of this, right? And so, you know, you start getting this pushback from people that it's like, he had crack cocaine, that's so much worse than marijuana, and they think they're scoring points. They're not. They're not scoring points when they say that, because marijuana is Schedule 1 compared to crack cocaine's Schedule 2. And so, you know, it's just... It's refreshing to hear that at least in their zeal to find something to pin on Hunter Biden, you know, some of these, you know, hardcore Republicans are at least going to be consistent enough to push back and say, but not for something like this. You know, there's plenty of other things we think we can get him on, and maybe there is, we'll find out. But not for something like this, not for something that impacts so many people, because we don't want to show him any favors because he's the president's son. But he also shouldn't be treated any different. because he's the president's son. And if millions of consumers of marijuana, you know, own handguns and are using handguns and they're not being prosecuted, you know, I mean, I think that there's certainly a certain number of people, you know, who have to take that into account. And, you know, if your zeal to get something on Hunter Biden is so great that you'll live with this, well, okay. But just remember that someday, because there's going to be some of you who smoke marijuana who are going to get caught with marijuana and a handgun, you know, in the glove box of your car, because you never leave home without your gun. And then what are you going to say then? Oh, it shouldn't apply to me. It should only apply to Hunter. So, you know, this is stuff that really needs to be thought about all the way around and needs to be properly addressed. And as a marijuana user and a marijuana advocate, my position is that the gun issue should have nothing to do with marijuana. They shouldn't be linked in any way, shape, or form, because people who have bias against handguns, you know, shouldn't have to bring that bias into a discussion about marijuana and vice versa. They're each separate things. They each have people who like to observe and follow them and people who don't. And that's the end of it. You know, we all know which one is safer and isn't going to kill people, but that's not even the issue here, right? The issue here is that they shouldn't be linked. And it's unfortunate when they do get linked. And if we would just make the marijuana legal, certainly, I mean, the guns are legal, right? Guns killing people and all this stuff, they're legal. That's not the issue. The issue is that the marijuana comes along, but you have more people these days who favor legal marijuana than legal guns. So I think it's really time that, you know, people stop acting as though this is a truly linked issue that needs to be continuously enforced. It doesn't, and there's just no reason, you know, to keep raising it for that purpose, and hopefully people will walk away from that and come up with something new. So that's what's going on with marijuana. There is a paper company, and I forget which one, another one I just looked at as I was getting ready to go on, and they will pay $4.20 to volunteers who smoke joints for science. Google $4.20 smoke joints for science, you'll find it. It's just one of those things that I'm like, you know, it's when I miss my buddy Blake. If he was around, he rolled the best joints in the world. He would go and he would do this for sure. Whether or not they'd have them is a whole other story. But what a great opportunity. What a great thing to put on your resume and to be able to tell your children about someday. So go roll your joints for science. Have fun. Get paid not a whole lot of money, but symbolically a fun amount of money. We're going to head back into the show now, and we're going to move forward in the second set to the post drums and one of Jerry's favorite tunes that he used to play during that time, and a tune that gets great coverage here, and one I really like, Black Peter. Let's hear it.
Just in the wind, it's warm through the door. But who can the weather command? Just and a friend or two, I love that hand.
Black Peter's a wonderful Garcia Hunter tune, released on Working Man's Dead in 1970. Robert Hunter was not afraid of death. He experienced it 1,000 times over. The American musician composed the lyrics to many of the Grateful Dead's most successful songs and played an essential role in curating the band's mythos, one that saw the psychedelic rock outfit earn hordes of dedicated fans, Deadheads, and one such song was Black Peter, written for the band's 1970 album, Working Man's Dead, which we said. By 69, the Dead were practically synonymous with the liberal drug culture of the hippie era. In June of that year, Robert Hunter and the gang were given a glass of apple juice laced with probably a full gram of crystal LSD, worth perhaps $50,000 in 1969 dollars. The intense trip that followed would completely reinvigorate Hunter's understanding of death and influence his subsequent lyrics for Black Peter. Bassist Phil Lesh would later recall tasting the LSD and the juice after a single sip. "I wish you could be where I am at right now. It's so beautiful," he told drummer Mickey Hart. "But I couldn't possibly play music now. I don't even know what music is. Still, there was a job to do, so the band played on anyway." So sure, of course, no doubt Owsley Stanley's Crystal LSD. Phil is at that point in time getting ready to start getting creative and write Box of Rain and some other stuff. Robert Hunter's already well into his way of writing the tunes for both American Beauty and Working Man's. And it's just a great time all the way around when they talk about that and what was happening when Hunter sat down and wrote these words and Garcia put the music to it. In the 80s and 90s, it was certainly one of Jerry's rotating post-drums second-set ballads, along with Morning Dew, Wharf Rat, and Stella Blue, kind of forming a four-song instead of three. This version is one of the highlights of this show, I think. Jerry's voice is really strong, if not just a bit ragged around the edges, the way the Deadheads liked it, with just enough emotion to really convey the song's meaning and its statement about the end of life. And as you could hear when he jumps into that guitar solo towards the end of the clip, the crowd roars in appreciation, both because of the effort that he's bringing to the table here with this, the energy he's playing. Again, this is now 2 years post Jerry diabetic coma, and during the era when everybody had said, going from the Fat Man Rock, showing a silhouette of a heavyset Jerry Garcia jumping up in the Michael Jordan pose for that same Nike ad, and then eventually moving to the Fit Man Rocks, because Jerry was dropping pounds and eating more healthy, and all of that good kind of stuff. And in 1988, he was sounding really, really great, and we really enjoyed it, and it was good. And we're gonna close out today's show with the encore, which we'll get to in 1 minute. I just want to say thank you to everyone for listening today. Another happy birthday shout out to Dan. When you guys listen to this, his birthday will be a few days old, but wherever you are, make sure you give him a shout out, because he's an important part of this team and your listening enjoyment as well. Stay tuned, because we are going to get Andras Kirshner on this show sometime in the next couple of weeks. We're very excited about that and look forward to having an opportunity to discuss so many things with him, both in the world of marijuana and the Grateful Dead. He's one of those guys who straddles both of our subsets of topics very nicely, and we're going to be very happy to have a chance to speak with him. And the summer marches on. Enjoy everything. See the most live music and outdoor music you can see. And we're going to close out here with Black Muddy River. It was played 66 times. The first was on December 15th, 1986, at Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. The last was on July 9th, 1995, at Soldier Field in Chicago. In fact, it looked like it was going to be the last song of the show, the encore, and it would have been the last song of a difficult summer tour. Turns out it would have also been the last song ever played in concert by the Dead. And whether Phil knew all that or not, he stepped in and decided, before they walked off stage, they weren't going. They wanted to leave everyone with a smile on their face, no bad taste in their mouths, and came out and played Box of Rain for a great second encore, which then became the last song ever played by the Grateful Dead in concert. By contrast, however, this version is just as is outstanding, and not the kind of piece of a hot mess that that one was with Jerry forgetting lyrics and looking like he barely had the strength and the energy to get through. And, you know, just really kind of sad to see. And in this show, you know, Jerry just has boundless energy. Perfect song with the, you know, right on the banks of the Mississippi River up there in the Twin Cities. So it was geographically appropriate for the venue. Mikey, JT, and I rolled off into the night. A crazy weekend in Mini. Then the next four shows on tour at Alpine. You know, how great would it be to have that kind of energy again, even if just for one night? Well, I'll tell you by the end of Fish Tour this summer, folks. Thank you, Psychedelics, is all I can say for what we experienced back then. To all of you, please enjoy the summer solstice and the beginning of summer, which comes up in a few days here. Please join us again next week. More great shows and more great guests on tap to bring in to entertain all of us with great stories about interesting times on the topics that we all love so much. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Talk to you later.
Sing me a song.